Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, along with Denise Miller, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow Pullman. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah and Whitman Recovery Community Centers. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. The Latah Recovery Community Center is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRCC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. Their hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Whitman Recovery Community Center is located at 226 East Main Street in Pullman. And you can contact the WRCC by phone at 509-715-1111 or by email at wrccprogrammanager@gmail.com. And their hours are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and across the table from me is Miss Denise. Hello, Denise.
Hello. Hello, Johnny. Hello, everyone.
And for the calendar, go to the LatahRecoveryCenter.org website, and you can see the calendar there on the homepage. And today's guest is a woman named Aaliyah Johnson via Zoom all the way from beautiful Tennessee, and she is an event designer turned recovering alcoholic into corporate vice president, thought leader, and recovery coach. Aaliyah has spent the last 17 years climbing the corporate ladder in both the event design space as well as the behavioral health industry. She has spent many years breaking stigmas in both community and professional settings. And welcome, Aaliyah.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Hello, Palouse.
Yeah, your old hometown.
Or
close to it.
Well, you were close to it, yeah. Grew up in Spokane Valley and graduated from WSU in December of 2008.
Fantastic.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs.
Yeah, we've got some, my side hustle besides this is Airbnb, and we've got Cougs coming into town for game this next weekend, so.
Yeah, I think it's family weekend this weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. Parents weekend. Yeah.
Parents
weekend. So I had to tear down all the U of I regalia, put up all the WSU regalia, which is a normal thing.
I could just
for
see
us.
You like having like one side and then it like flips, you know, from WSU to U of I. That's so funny.
Exactly.
I'd rather you do it though than Cougars ripping stuff apart, right?
That's right. That's right. Only happens at football games. But Aaliyah,
we'd
love to hear you share your experience, strength, and hope with us about your very interesting story, which you put into a memoir called Caffeine, Nicotine, and an Audacious Life. You say a dream, I say an audacious life. And we'll talk about that a little later, but why don't you warm us up with your history?
Yeah, so I am a woman in long-term recovery. My sobriety date is May 16th, 2012. At the time in my life, I couldn't afford treatment or a therapist, and so the walls of AA and the community and the fellowship is where I went. So I tried to get sober at 21 and then again at 23, and it finally stuck at 25. You know, it takes what it takes, and being able to kind of learn, you know, each time I got sober. And, you know, as I talk about in my book, I was arrested 4 times for various different things, all stemming from my addiction, which, you know, I thought at the time started when I was kind of in that college transitioning to real life aspect. But as I've gotten into my own healing and my own journey, I realized it stemmed way sooner than that in my childhood and just kind of growing up. And I didn't really drink very much when I was in high school. I was active in ASB and cheerleading, volleyball, track, tennis, all the things that I could get my hands on. But going into, you know, kind of the party scene, and that's when peer pressure starts, and, you know, all the different pressures that we have, not just as high schoolers. I feel like in today's society, it's, you know, all the way in middle school as well. But, you know, just really being able to kind of adventure out with some of those parties when I was in high school. And then my parents ended up getting divorced shortly after my high school graduation. And so going off to college was kind of my experience of, yay me, I'm going to be on my own. I can make my own decisions. I started college at 17 because my birthday is in the summertime. So kind of starting to have that freedom and feel what that was like really, you know, accelerated from there. My first semester at Washington State, I got a 1.2, which, you know, that's a really stellar semester, which put my scholarship at risk. So I had to kind of, you know, turn the tables, and I was able to bounce back with a 3.6 my second semester, which was great. So then I was able to have, you know, continue to go back and get my education and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, transitioning from college, you know, I loved, you know, being the party planner, was the life of the party, you know, had that whole mentality all through college. And, you know, I got my degree in leadership and professional studies with an emphasis on event design. So wanted to continue to have that. And as one could imagine, that became a very slippery slope for my addiction. You know, I was taking shots with the groomsmen and, you know, having drying the bride's tears and putting together a pencil skirt and then taking another shot. You know, there was a lot of different moving parts in that. And after my first arrest, they went through, you know, an analysis and they deemed me as a high functioning alcoholic because it was just Groundhog's Day every day. You know, I would have the events at night and drink and be out until 3 a.m., come home, sleep for a couple hours, and then continue about my day, pounding a shot and having some cigarettes before I went to work. So it became this very vicious cycle for me. And, you know, a lot of people really said, hey, you know, is everything all right? Are you okay? And I was like, yeah, it's just the lifestyle. It's, you know, it's not going to be forever. It's, you know, it's just a phase. But that phase ended up taking over my life. And, you know, after a couple of my opportunities to go to AA that were court appointed opportunities is what I used to call those. I marked the boxes and said, okay, yep, I'll do that. Okay, yep, I'll do that community service. But nothing was really sticking with me as far as different things that I was going through. You know, I was in domestic violence relationships. I was in fist fights. I had sexual assaults. I had arguments with bouncers at bars. I had arguments with my family members and fights with my boyfriends. And, you know, really being able to take that time after my fourth arrest, you know, I knew something had to change and I just wasn't sure quite what that was. And the thing that was different about my fourth arrest than my other ones were I told them that I would wait it out. I didn't take my phone call and I wanted to just sit there because I realized that my life truly had become unmanageable, which is something that they teach us in the walls of AA, and being able to have that powerlessness. And so I sat there for 72 hours, went to my arraignment. The judge said what he said, and I was able to walk home from jail. I lived close enough that I was able to walk and got to work that day. And my boss kind of sat me down and she said, hey, you know, I don't really know what's going on, but take the week to figure it out in a sense. And she was like, we'll cover your events this week, but you know, something's not, you're not performing to the way that we know that you are able to perform. And I had let everything in my life just become something that was this vicious cycle. And I talk about this in my book, but being able to look at my life now and being able to have the revelations that I do, I felt like I was standing in the middle of a crowded room screaming at the top of my lungs and nobody could hear me. And I think one thing that I used to do really well was to put on the face of fine, right? You know, we put on, how are you doing? I'm fine. I'm right. Fine.
Sure.
you know, and that's a face of the face of fine. And, after about my first, I don't know, couple of months, my sponsor said to me, she goes, Aaliyah, you need to come up with something different than fine. And I said, well, I'm not good and I'm not great, but I'm also not bad. Like, I'm fine. Why can't I just say I'm fine? And so she challenged me. And at the time I was still a smoker. So I kind of got a little flippant and I was like, well, I'm just running on caffeine, nicotine, and a dream, which is now the name of my memoir. But that became kind of the motto. And I just continued to show up to AA, do the steps with my sponsor, sponsor other women. And, you know, after a couple years of being sober, I really just wanted to be an advocate for other people. And I wanted to live my recovery out loud. Anybody who knew me growing up and knows me now, I live very boldly. I am a jump in with both feet type of person that says, don't touch the burner. Well, I'm going to touch it because I want to know how hot it really is, right?
Sure.
And so being able to navigate living boldly in recovery has been a really beautiful thing. It's had its challenges, obviously, but it's been something that has been the most rewarding thing that I could have done for myself. And I tell my patients today, you know, at the moment of everything that I did, looking back, you know, in the moment, it was exactly what I wanted to do, right? And so I don't have regrets, because if I would have done even one little thing differently, I wouldn't be sitting here having this interview with the two of you. You know, I don't know where I would be if I would have done something differently. And I am damn proud of the person that I've become today. And that's not something that I could always say about my journey and about myself. So, you know, kind of fast forward to still being party planner, but also being in recovery, I just kind of said, I need something different. And, you know, I started going to church and got into my relationship and my walk with God and ended up getting baptized in 2015 and wanted to fulfill my purpose and continue to use my past as an asset. So, again, as somebody who lives boldly and jumps in with both feet, I did all the research I could on, you know, behavioral health facilities and what the top ones were, and just kind of started applying to see, you know, what would open up and where that would lead me. And, you know, my therapist always says, do the footwork and surrender the outcome.
Right. I love that. When I read that in the book, it's like, yeah, that's for a therapist. That's very AA.
Yeah. So I ended up selling my event planning business. I had an event planning business of my own at that time and started working in behavioral healthcare in 2015. And I, you know, have climbed the corporate ladder and I am where I am now. And I have a business on the side as a public speaker and an author and, you know, just really living my life today to advocate for other people and to show up for other people. And, you know, like I talk about in my book, If by writing this book, it helps one person and that one person was me, it was worth it. And I think being able to share, you know, we have the capacity to have a ripple effect of greatness in any type of a situation that we're in. Like everybody is walking around in this world with something, right? We're walking around wounded. And if there's something that I went through and there's purpose in that pain, I'm going to share it.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. And that's, you know, for me, that relates very much to my, you know, service work in AA.
Yeah.
I've been doing AA since February 14, 1994.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. 30 years in. And it takes what it takes to get here. I loved in your book, the story of talking with your cellmate and just those simple questions. I actually had a friend who did, you know, said something very similar to me. So that really rang home to me.
Yeah.
But,
Well, and I think too, it's like everybody always, you know, with the hustle and bustle culture that we live in today, it's, you know, everybody asks what you do for work or what, you know, what was your most recent vacation or whatever. Nobody actually really asks you if you're happy.
Right. 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 We kind of joke in the rooms, here, the difference between normies and AAs is if an AA asks you how you're doing, he actually wants to know.
Right.
So true. Yeah, so correct.
Exactly.
I feel like I'm very good with being vulnerable. It's like if you ask me a question, you're probably going to get the actual answer.
Yeah, I wasn't good at it at first just because it wasn't something that I was, you know, brought up around. And you know, I had that really enmeshed relationship with my mom. And, you know, it wasn't until a gentleman in the walls of AA, he said to me, he said, I've seen you in and out of these walls for the last couple of years, and you can make this as easy or as hard on yourself as you want, and the choice is up to you. So I had that echoing in my mind. And then, you know, my dad always used to say, you can do anything you put your mind to. So, you know, I think that there is that vulnerability piece that I didn't start to engage in myself until early on in my recovery. You know, you could tell me what your problems were, and I would have a solution to the problem before you ended up telling me the whole problem. Me letting people into my world, into my space, was a completely different story. And like you said, Denise, it took some healing of my, you know, some healing of my heart and my wounds to be able to start to say, okay, you know, people do want to know how my day's doing. People do want to know, you know, what makes me happy or what I look forward to in life, or, you know, anything like that. And so it is a matter of letting people in to see who you are and what you offer as a person.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot in doing the steps and walking through recovery and discovering, you know, what are the things that you need to know about yourself to be self-aware, and then the direction that you're going in and what you need to do to care for yourself well in recovery so that you can stick to that. You know, there's just, there's a lot. I've never been in any kind of anything that was close to what recovery is at all. Yeah. I hadn't even been in counseling before I entered into recovery at 40. So.
Yeah. And it's, you know, another thing I tell my patients too, is my worst day in recovery doesn't match my best day when I was drinking.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's right.
So true.
That's a good old cherub too. My worst day sober is not even close to my best day out there drinking. Running and gunning, doing all those other mind-altering drugs. You know, I grew up a few years before you. Yeah, Denise laughs. He's old.
No, we're middle-aged. I've been telling you that. Did you turn 70 yet?
Yes.
Age is just a number, and you're only as old as you feel.
You just became a little bit older than middle-aged, Tony. It's 40 to 70.
Yeah, well, I passed it up.
Just barely.
But I'm still here.
You're doing good.
Don't talk about me in the past tense yet.
No.
Not for nothing, but, you know, the drugs, besides alcohol, I mean, they were all part of my story, but, you know, alcohol was first and alcohol was last because it did it for me. You know, it took care of that, you know, insecure kid who grew up in, you know, not too different a household, you know, a lot of screaming and yelling, a lot of holes punched in the walls. You know, also a chain of toxic relationships, you know, going forward. And, you know, it wasn't until I was 40 also that I had a moment of clarity, like they say, and went in, decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because my mother had actually gotten sober and stayed sober the last 10 years of her life with the help of AA. I don't think she ever worked the steps, but she was so involved in the fellowship, and she had real friends that, you know, her life was really good for those last 10 years. And I got to meet somebody I had never known before.
That's awesome.
And I've had people say that about me, too. You know, they say in AA, other people will notice the change before you do. And I had a lot of people, you know, people I worked with who would say, yeah, there's something different with you.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it is. And I'm like, I'm not going to tell them I quit drinking.
See, and I did. Like, when people were starting to recognize that about me, I was like, oh, I'm sober. And people were like, oh, you're on the bandwagon. Like, I even had somebody ask me that recently when I was in Washington. I was visiting with some friends, and one of the people that was there said to me, you know, well, we used to drink together all the time. And I said, yeah, that was 13 years ago. Like, and he looked at me and he was like, so we're at a wedding though. Are you going to have a drink? And I said, no. And he goes, so how long is your bandwagon this time?
You know,
it's moments like that though, that I will say I love, because I use those as teachable moments of, you know, alcoholics don't take vacations. you know, because people are like, oh, you're on vacation, you can drink. Well, you know, alcoholics take vacations in a certain regard. You are not able to drink when you're on vacation. Have a mocktail or something. Or people who are like, oh, well, you know, we're celebrating a wedding or we're celebrating a birthday. Those are things that I do differently today.
Right.
In my recovery. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Absolutely.
And I think people just don't, you know, we have such a plethora of things available at such a convenience these days that people don't even think, you know, or my favorite question is, well, what do you do for fun now that you're sober? Oh. Well, there's a ton more fun to be had sober.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I loved everything I did that I could remember when I was drinking. And I don't point fingers at things that I used to do by any means. I have a great life today that I love more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what works for me. Everybody's journey is different, whether you're in recovery or not in recovery.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I totally get it. You know, I used to have a cute little saying when people would say, you know, you want a drink? I'd politely say no. And if they pressed on, I'd say, well, I have an allergy. And they really, you know, yeah. When I drink, I break out in handcuffs, misdemeanors, and felonies.
Yeah.
It happened. I've heard that. Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't say that to the boss at work, but, you know, in a social right. setting. And, you know, I found as time has gone by, you know, you talk about stigma. You know, when AA was first founded in the 30s, their concept of anonymity, it had a lot more to do with people identifying in public because it was a big risk, you know, professionally, socially. And today, you know, it's more of a thing. I go by the pseudonym Radio Johnny. And the reason I do that is because I'm broadcasting and, you know, we have that tradition, you know, stay anonymous at press, radio, and films, because I don't necessarily want to be the poster child for AA. That's just the way I look at it. Everybody looks at it differently. And, you know, in your case, you're using your experience, you know, the whole of the experience, not just the AA part, because you also use counseling, which it was probably available, but it wasn't something I engaged in. Plus, I'm a guy. I don't need counseling.
Oh, you can't have feelings.
Well, I mean, it wasn't something that I engaged in until these last couple of years.
Oh, right.
You know, after I got into the industry and was kind of learning more things. And, you know, obviously, like, with your sobriety date and my sobriety date and Denise, your sobriety date also, you know, there was very minimal resources back in those days. Whereas now, you know, there are so many different things. And I think, you know, one thing that I've learned about working in the behavioral health industry now as a whole is it is a constant change and there's always something new coming out. And, you know, I am somebody who likes to educate myself on those things so then I can maybe better help my patients when it comes to, you know, different things and being able to say, hey, well, like this, and this is all out there. And I encourage people to try because what works for me is different than what works for you, which is what's different than what works for Denise. You know, everybody kind of has to find, you know, their tool belt to be able to navigate what their recovery journey looks like. And it wasn't until 2018 that I did a workshop that really allowed me to check out that childhood trauma and really look into that. And after that, you know, my first 7 years of recovery was all strictly AA. And then when I started working where I work and got into the behavioral health industry, it was one thing where I had the opportunity to do a workshop. And it ended up being something that at the end of the week, I was like, okay, I need to still process quite a bit of all of this, you know? And so that was when I started seeing a therapist, and it was something that was pretty regular for me for those first few years as I kind of navigated some different things that, you know, came up for me during that workshop. And, you know, healing, I feel like every layer of what we heal demands a different version of who we are and who we can become. And I think that, you know, I pray that till my dying day, I'm still learning things about myself that will help me with my own journey and help other people as well, you know, be service work.
Mm-hmm. Growing, evolving, all the things. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I would start with the counselor today, except I don't think I have enough time to get through everything. Just kidding. I've actually found a lot of solace and counseling in the rooms as well. Just I've been doing it for a long damn time. I've been able to address a lot of those issues from childhood, not only through the rooms, but I also have a sibling who is, well, sort of a member, but you know, she's been going to therapy and counseling for decades now, and she thinks if she lives to be 100, she'll almost be cured. But you know, we talk, you know, at length about stuff because I was the last of four, and we're 14, 12, and 7 years apart from me. So, you know, she was the last one in the house when the wheels almost literally came off, and experienced a lot of the same things I did. So, you know, we kind of therapy counsel each other on those things, and she brings in a lot of the things that she's learned from her professional relationships with people. So it's been really helpful, and it saved me a ton of money. You know, because she's the one paying $200 an hour down in the Bay Area, so that works for me.
Sharing knowledge is good.
It is.
That's right.
Sharing knowledge and sharing tools.
That's right. That's right, and that's what we do in the rooms of AA too. And you know, I really, I'm sure you understand that talking to people who have had your experience, and like you've said, using your experience. Working with your clientele to help them make discoveries about themselves, because that's really what the program of AA is. They say self-knowledge availed us nothing, but that was before we got sober and went through those 12 suggestions and started getting our stuff together. We really do end up gaining a lot of self-knowledge, usually the unpleasant variety. But unless it's out on the table, you can't deal with it. That's why we do a fourth and fifth step, is to lay it all out on the table, you know, put it in writing, like they say, and and look at it. And, you know, I would imagine the part of you that's a recovery coach, and this goes for Denise as well, is getting people, allowing people to be comfortable enough to get it out on the table. How do you do that?
So I find for myself, and I notice this with others, that being able to say things out loud lessens the power that it holds over you. So being able to process and have someone else hear, and then I'm a person of faith, and so I believe that in that also the Holy Spirit is moving and being able to, you know, gently convict and like guide people in next steps and stuff like that. So I think that is very helpful. And I was just going to say that I find I've been in recovery now for 12 years. I struggled in my 30s with substances, and I would say that my life is better now than it was before I ever even used. So there's just been so much that I've gained through working on things about myself and community. It's just been amazing. It was really great. But yeah, just being there for others. I mean, that narrative of, okay, I'm going to work because I'm showing up for people who still struggle or aren't even wanting recovery yet. They don't even like, they haven't even lined that up yet. Because hundreds of people did that for me in my recovery, you know, Lord, I'm showing up for your people. Just like you had people show up for me. It's good. And my heart's in it because I've been there.
Yeah. Amen to that. My sobriety and my wisdom has grown through the process of the millions that, you know, went on before me. In this AA program. And, you know, I talk with people, you know, like yourself, Leah, and Denise, and people here at the Recovery Center, you know, about, you know, what's the latest and greatest, you know, what other recovery programs are out there now, you know, that have spun off of the basic concepts of AA. And you have things like Celebrate Recovery.
Celebrate Recovery. That's now Restoration Night. At least at our church.
And there's another one. Well, there's Smart Recovery.
There's all recovery.
And a friend of mine does a smart recovery program back in Philadelphia, and he also does a AA program, and he finds them complementary, but at times contradictory. I'm one of the AA believers that I got to act my way into right thinking. Mm-hmm. Where evidently SMART approaches it where you change your thinking and your actions will change. But AA is a backward program for backwards people like me. So, but, you know.
And then mine is identify your false beliefs and then replace them with God's truth about you.
Right, exactly.
Go figure.
And there's a lot of different angles. And I imagine, Leah, you work with, people from a lot of different angles because you have to meet them where they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would echo what Denise said also is, sharing and just putting things out on the table and kind of what you were referencing earlier too is, we can't address it unless we put it out on the table. And I think, for me, I've really tried to create a safe place for not just my patients and my clients, but my friends, my family members, I've tried to create a space where they feel like they can take up space and they can ask for help and being able to have that given to me when I was able to really accept, accept what was going on in my life. And, the serenity prayer is in the walls everywhere. And, I had to first acknowledge where I was at before I could accept it. And because of the patience and the safety that the women in AA provided to me, I felt like I could be seen and I felt like I could let my walls down and I could, have people to help navigate and sit with me in my if I needed to sit in it for a little bit, just to not unpack there. Right. And so just being able to have that same safe space for people in my life is something that I try to do because it was given to me as well. And that patience aspect of it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We weren't meant to do life alone. And so in recovery, we've got people, who know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're social creatures. We need mm-hmm. each other to make things work all around. Yeah. I mean, if there weren't farmers, I'd be hard pressed to, grow enough food for me to eat. Yeah.
That sounds stressful.
And exactly.
I'd be living at my adult daughter's house. She knows how to do that stuff. I'd be like, oh, your mama's moving in.
We're hungry. We're bringing the rest of the family over. Yeah. And, again, it relates to, the emotional side of it too. If you don't have somebody to dump on, so to speak, or you're not willing to let, someone you love dump on you, it can be really lonely out there. Especially so for people that are dealing with addictions, because we push people away to, keep them from interfering with our, our addiction, people. If you just let me drink like I wanted to, everything would be fine, You talk about, things that have happened to you and how you've dealt with them. And in your book, which I want to talk about a little bit here, you talked about, when you describe events in your life in the book, you are frighteningly detailed about the sexual assaults in particular, what led up to them, and, the drinking adventures and the jail adventures. What allowed you to speak so openly about that in that print? Because I've met a lot of people who have had similar situations, women and men as well, and they're really loath to dive into it very deeply at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think for me, being able to be raw and be authentic were things that helped me in my recovery when other people could be so raw and authentic. And one thing that I did in my addiction was I masked a lot of things, kind of like I mentioned earlier, as far as being in the middle of a crowded room screaming off the top of my lungs and nobody could hear me. And being able to live boldly and be able to lean into the uncomfortable conversations. I feel like there are not a lot of people out there that talk about those things. And I think that that also causes society to go inward and to feel alone in what's happening. And so I wanted to use my past as boldly as I could and as authentically as I could, because I know what it was like for me to go through those instances and to not have somebody who could relate, or having maybe a handful of people that could relate to what I was going through. And I think that, you know, we are in this mode of instant gratification of different things. And I think that that causes people to push away their emotions and to not feel them and to not talk about them, and to put on that face of fine. And I got into recovery and I told myself that I would live boldly, because I know that that's what I needed for me when I was younger. I just didn't have the voice or felt like I had the empowerment within myself to be able to stand up and say that and to be able to talk about it. And I think working in the industry for the last 10 years, we lean into hard conversations. And I think that that was also something that for me, I was able to be raw and vulnerable with the people in my life, and nobody pointed fingers at me. Nobody shunned me for it. Nobody made me feel guilt. Nobody made me feel shame. Those were all things that I was creating up here. And because I started speaking in jail, like I started speaking in jails and domestic violence shelters probably in year two of my recovery, because I didn't want any woman to feel alone in what they were going through. And so I chose to live boldly, and I still choose to live boldly and to be raw and gregarious. And I've had people that jump on board with that, and I have people that are like, whoa, are you sure you should talk about that? Well, what, you know, and it is like, it is leaning into, you know, I always found comfort in the chaos, and I chose in my recovery to lean into those uncomfortable conversations because not enough people are having them.
Right. That's when you say lean into it, that leads to that word that I asked you about in an email.
Yeah.
Intentionality.
Intentionality.
What does intentionality look like to you?
Yeah. So intentionality to me is being present in what I'm doing and being intentional with my time. And what I mean by that is in my recovery, I was such a go, 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 go type of a person. And I wasn't taking the time to enjoy the moments that I was in because I was so focused on, you know, and being an event planner, right? So like I had everything down to a T as far as the schedule, all of that sort of stuff. But the more that I tried to plan my life as an event, the more out of control it got. And it was like, I couldn't stay present or intentional with what I was doing because I was already thinking, you know, I was future tripping of everything right. that was going on in my life. And it wasn't until I had to be comfortable with being bored, right? You know, mm-hmm. I was such a, and I talk about this in my book too, as far as being a human being versus a human doing. Right. And there are a lot of things that I looked back on in my life that, or I see pictures of that, even like, even in my first couple years of recovery, where I was like, oh, I was there, but like, I wasn't present for it. And I mm-hmm. wasn't intentional for it. And it wasn't until that I could really make that connection of life is about moments, and life is about creating those beautiful moments when they happen and being able to overcome them if they're challenging. We can't, and I shouldn't say we, I couldn't live fully in what was going on because I wasn't present with myself. And so I early in recovery, I started hiking and spending a lot of time in nature. I mean, we camped and did wakeboarding and water skiing and stuff growing up as kids, but sitting in my own solitude was what I needed to do, and being comfortable with being by myself and being comfortable in the calm, right. which is what opened up the intentionality aspect. And so to me today, you know, I have do not disturb on my phone, and I have good boundaries around when I'm with somebody, whether it's a friend or a loved one or going to a concert or going to a football game, you know, I want to be in those moments because I feel like a majority of my life, I was always worried about the next thing, or I was always chasing the next thing, that I wasn't enjoying the present moment that I was in.
Right. You know, there's the old saying, don't just sit there, do something. I flipped it on its head. I say, don't just do something, sit there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helpful for me. So
I
guess I understood it more than I thought. And that's great.
Yeah.
You cover a lot of those things in your book. Again, it's Caffeine, Nicotine, and a Dream. And I know it's available on Amazon because that's where I got it.
Yeah, it's also on Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Nobles. In hardback and soft. Softback.
Yep. Softback and ebook on all of the platforms.
And I understand if you contact the Audacious Ally dot, what is it, .com?
Yes.
.com.
For my email or just my website? Yeah.
Your
for
website.
My email,
Yeah, you can go on.
Yeah, my website is the Audacious Ally. .com, and then my email is theaudaciousally@gmail.com.
Right. And you can contact that and order it through you. And you can probably even get an autograph out of it, maybe?
Yes, you can get an autograph. Yep, you sure can get an autograph copy through my website. That's available as well. I actually just got a new shipment of hardback books today. So.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. And the price is very reasonable, by the way. So, you know, I encourage anybody who's listening to us to check that out. It's a pretty fast read. I'm not a really fast reader because I'm a very intentional reader.
Great. I love that.
Yeah. If I get to a point when I'm reading and suddenly I'm like, where am I on this page? I'll back up a page and go, where did I go off the rails here?
Sure.
Because in your book in particular, because it's very thought-provoking, which is great for me, and I think for other people too it would be. You know, how many people have I known that have come into AA and they, you know, maybe they've gotten nudge from the judge, so to speak, or whatever, and you know, they come in and they stay a while, and it finally comes to them that maybe this really is something I can do. Because of, you know, sitting there and listening and hearing the same stories over and over again from that one old guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think the best share I ever heard, and we'll close it up here in a minute, the best share I ever heard was in Hamilton, Montana.
Mm-hmm.
There was a young man there who, in his drinking, got in an accident and suffered a brain injury, traumatic brain injury. But went to meetings all the time. There was one meeting on a Thursday night there. And all they said was, my name's Bobby, and thanks to God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober today. And I went, well, that's kind of a short share. So I asked somebody, a local who had been there quite a while, and he goes, no, that's all he ever shares. That's it to him. He gets it. You know, he talks outside the meeting. He's not, you know, totally wiped out. But, that's what the program means to him, and that's what he's gotten out of it. And he's sober.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, Leah, we are about out of time here. Once again, I apologize for not working the Zoom totally well, but
it's okay.
But we got through it. I hope I didn't hold you up from any other appointments.
No, you didn't. I blocked out the afternoon to meet with you guys. I've been looking forward to this, and I'm just grateful that I was able to be there in Pullman. I can't believe that was already a month ago.
Right. Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, we're so glad you could come on today.
So much happened in the last month. It's been so great. What did you say, Denise?
Oh, I was just saying I'm so glad that you could come on today and share. It's been really great.
I'm grateful to be here. And Denise, let me know what you think about the book as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, and next time you're in the neighborhood, you know, the LRC is open from 10 to 8.
And I'm actually going to be working with her on getting out a couple times in 2026. So sure keep you guys posted on different things with that. Would love to swing over there and see you guys and chat and do all the things. So.
Yeah, we can sit and talk in person next time, and that would be great.
Yes.
All righty. Well, it's time to close it up. Denise, thank you again.
And thank you, Johnny.
Aaliyah, thank you again. And
thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Use my usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol, drugs, behavioral health, you do.
Sing us, play, how we cheered for more.